Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 76 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer. Bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming. News and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. It's been another couple of great weeks of gaming here in the gaming capital of the world. How's it going, Cody?
It's going all right. The Colts did not lose last Sunday, so...
Oh, I see what you did there. They had the bye week, huh?
They did.
I figured they were going to find some way to lose anyway.
That's right. No, we need to keep Curtis Painter nice and healthy for the rest of the year so we can get our draft pick, and then, then he can go away.
I just don't even want to talk about it anymore.
Okay. Well, let's talk about something else. How about...
War.
Games.
How about war?
War.
Today,
in the grim future of 2011,
there is only war. At least war games. And this has been a long time coming. And there's been a lot of build up, I guess, to this war game episode. And that's what we're going to be talking about this show. We're going to just give it our own sort of common gamer spin on things, as we tend to do. Just talking about the world of war games, what we know about it, and what we've learned.
How someone who is not familiar with it might approach it, and games they might try.
Yeah, maybe some entry points there. And we're going to be, as part of that, reviewing a interesting game from GMT Games called Maneuver. It's got some additional vowels in there, but yeah, it's pronounced maneuver. So we'll be doing that, but we've got a huge rundown coming up because we had the game on game day.
It's
so
epic.
Get ready for it.
All right, it's time for the rundown where we tell you all of the great games and other geekery we've been doing, and this is a biggin, as they say.
They do say that.
They do say.
Yeah, it's been a big week, mainly because of one big event. This past Saturday, we had the first annual Game On Game Day, which I'm sure we've been talking about for quite a while now.
Yes.
And it turned out fantastically.
About 70, 80 folks came out for the first one. We had listeners come from all over, local and not local.
And here's the thing, is that I know that the last couple episodes on the show, we've been talking about it and, encouraging people to come down, but... It's not like this thing was planned to be a convention of any sort, It was just like, it was really nothing different than the Game On Game Night. It was same venue and, it's just, longer time.
And that was one of the best things about it was that it was very kind of low maintenance. It was nice because the person who usually hosts it, Sean Johnson, he's the youth pastor at this church, so he has access to this really nice play space, and he just reserved it on the church calendar, and we got the word out, and that was pretty much all the work we did. I mean, we had a few tournaments, but they were organized kind of late in the game, but it was pretty much just to bring what you want to play, and other people are going to bring their games, and you just play board games for 12 hours.
Yeah, I mean, and Sean did a great job of organizing. We had like a ping pong tournament and a Dominion tournament, but it was still very casual in the way it was done, so there wasn't a lot of super amount of prep time, which was great, and I think a lot of people came away from it thinking, this is what a game event should be like, just casual, people getting together. What do you want to play? Let's play it,
We'll have to do it again.
Yeah, definitely. So we're going to be talking about sort of what we played at the Game On game day. My day started right at the very beginning at 9 o'clock and got to play a couple of new games that I had just received from Myriad Games. And by the way, we haven't talked about Myriad Games. That's our great sponsor.
We've been remiss.
Yes, Myriad Games sponsors our show on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. They're a great local store in New Hampshire, but also have a great web presence with myriadgames.com. They have their MVP memberships and all that great stuff that we've mentioned before. And the week before this, the game day here, I had requested a couple of games that were new to me. Well, one was new to me and one is new to everyone. And one of the new to me game was Can't Stop. which is an old game from the 80s designed by Sid Sackson. It's a dice rolling kind of press your luck game. And I've seen it on Board Game Geek a lot, but it's, you know, one of those games you got to find it in the thrift store or something like that. It's, you know, but now Griffin Games has reprinted it in a very nice new edition.
Very retro.
Yeah.
It looks like it's out of the 60s or 70s.
It does, yeah. And just a great, fun game. And so I requested that one because I never played it before. And then a brand new game that had just come out, I think I mentioned it last episode, from Don DX Vaccarino. Yeah. Called Kingdom Builder, which was released at, I believe, at Essen this year. It turned out that Dan was able to get me a copy of that. And I don't think, Dan at Myriad, I don't think that Myriad went to any great, you know, amazing lengths as far as, like, you know, we called a guy, I had it shipped in, you know, but they
just had it.
They have their finger on the pulse of what new stuff is coming in. He had it coming in and it came right out to me. So, you know, the one of the best parts of the game day was talking with Jeremy Salinas, Drakenstrike, you know, does those great videos. He came to our game day and he saw Kingdom Builder and he said, do you want to play that? I'm like, yeah, let's play. And he said, where did you get a copy of that? I haven't been able to find it. I'm like, wow.
And that's a feat. Because
yeah, Jeremy Salinas.
We're usually slumming around Drakenstrike Manor saying, right. Hey, you've got this new game.
Can we borrow it? Yeah, can we play it? Because he gets all the stuff brand new. So that was kind of cool to know that, you know, Myriad was able to hook us up with that stuff. So Myriad Games, you know, great game store. We talk about them a lot. Check them out.
So how was Kingdom Builder?
Kingdom Builder was pretty good. I need to get a few more plays in of it. It's definitely got a very nice gateway game sort of a feel to it. You know, it's a game that has a lot of, it's this four-piece modular board. It comes with 8 pieces and you put 4 of them together. And it's a very simple mechanic in the game. You have a card that represents a kind of terrain. And the board has all these hexes with different kinds of terrain on them. And you have this big pile of wooden houses, which count as settlements. You know, kind of like Settlers of Catan style settlements.
Yep.
And on your turn, you turn over the terrain card, and it has a particular kind of terrain. You have to build 3 settlements onto that kind of terrain. And then you can take additional actions, because if you build settlements next to particular hexes, they have these little tokens that you can get. They're like buildings. And you get the token, and then you can perform additional actions that will allow you to either put additional settlements onto the board or to move settlements that you've already put on the board to other locations. And the reason why you're doing all this is that at the beginning of the game, there are 3 cards called Kingdom Builder cards that determine how points are scored at the end of the game. There's 10 cards in the game that come with the game, but you only ever use 3 of them. And so that changes the victory conditions and what you're going for each time. And it might be that you want to end up at the end with the biggest total cluster of settlements, or you want to have the most in a straight line, or you want to have most that are next to water or something like that. But it's different every time. And so, you know, there's some interesting strategy that evolves in the game from that.
So the big question,
yeah,
is it the next Ticket to Ride, Carcassonne, what have you?
I don't think so. I think it's really good. And it was one that I game shared from Myriad, and I think I am going to go ahead and buy, because I think I can get it to the table quite a bit. I like it because of the replayability factor to it. It's going to be different every time. But I think that the way that the Kingdom Builder cards is written is unnecessarily complex. It's almost just the way the language is written on the cards. It makes it hard to understand what exactly you're going for. Now, once you play the game a few times, it's not going to matter at all. But I just found that for a game that has such an easy turn order, I mean, I pretty much explained all the rules to you just in, you know, this short amount of time. You know, the turn goes very, very quickly. But there's just some little picky details and intricacies about it that might make it maybe a little bit too complex for a brand new gamer or a non-gamer that's coming into it, more so than Ticket to Ride. I got to give it a few more plays to see, but I give it a thumbs up or whatever we call it, a buy or a, you know, a awesome or a 10 out of, I don't know.
Nice. It's good to know you're invested in the show.
How long have we been doing this?
Yeah.
But no, I think it's a pretty good game. So I played that. I don't think Jeremy was quite as impressed with it, but
he's not impressed with a lot of things.
No. Well, he's impressed with some things, but so I continued playing with Jeremy and some other folks, and he brought out some games that he had gotten from Board Game Geek Con. So Drakenstrike went to BGG Con for a couple of days and then flew back, and the very next morning came to the game on game day.
Committed.
We weren't expecting to see him at all, because we'd gotten like a message from him on our message board saying, just landed in Dallas. And we're like, oh man, he's there this weekend. Okay, that's fine. But no, he came back in and he had bought some stuff at BGG. And we played a game by Michael Schott called Coney Island. Hmm. And this is sort of a resource management game where you're building attractions on Coney Island, roller coasters, bumper cars, things like that. You're putting workers and showmen out. And there's three resources in the game. You have resources, which are kind of these just red and white cubes. Okay. I kept looking in the book to see if they actually represent something, but they didn't seem to. And you have money, and then you have victory points. And so you can manipulate all three of those resources in different ways, you know, trading in money for victory points or victory points for resources or, you know, money for, you know, and all these different permutations so that you can eventually, of course, get the most points. I liked it. I thought because of the artwork on it, it's very cartoony sort of art. So I thought, oh, it's going to be kind of a light game like Zooloretto. You know, it's another Michael Schacht game. Maybe I can play this with my kids. Well, an hour into the game, I'm like, oh, no. This is not a key game for kids at all, really. I mean, well, you know, not for really young kids like mine. But I think it's a very solid design. I'm just not sure if I liked it that much because it's a game that has very tight resource management. You know, like you can only ever have five resources or five dollars ever in the game, and so you have to manage these very, very small amounts of things, and I need a game with a little bit more margin of error. I played my very first game of Dungeon Run.
Yes, I'm very interested to hear what you thought. Yeah, I did not get a chance to play it, sadly.
And when I think Cody and I, even after we record this podcast, are going to play our first game of that this evening.
Oh, so, I hope so.
And we'll be able to check that out. I'm sure we'll mention it together on a future episode. But I really enjoyed it. It's a game that's got all this typical dungeon crawling tropes about it, and you know, where you're trying to go through a dungeon and, you know, tiles are being laid out. In that way, it's very similar to Castle Ravenloft and those kind of games. You have square tiles and you're going into different rooms. But as you enter rooms, you can either have encounters or you might get treasure. You know, it's got all the stuff to it that you normally would. It's got a very interesting dice rolling mechanic for resolving combat that I haven't really seen before. It's D6 based, and you're rolling a certain numbers of D6s against, attacking rolls
there
a certain number.
Go.
Yeah, spit it out, John. Attacking rolls a certain number of dice. Defense rolls a certain number of dice, and you kind of match things up. You know, like I said, we'll probably talk about this game in a future episode and give a little bit more detail on it. But the main kind of twist in the game is that you're trying to get to the big boss at the very end, and then after you've defeated the boss drops this summoning stone. I don't think I mentioned this. This game is set in the same world as Summoner Wars, the other game from Plat Hat Games that they made. And so they drop the summoner stone, and then one of the players has to pick it up and run for the exit. And then, you know, that's when it becomes kind of like Cutthroat Caverns, where, you know, it's everybody works together to beat the bad guy, and then, you know, you have to be the last person out or try to be the first person out with this summoning stone. So then you're attacking each other. And so that is a very, very interesting part of the game, and then that I really liked. I felt like games like dungeon crawls have this tendency to be clunky, you know?
Yeah.
Descent, as much as I absolutely love Descent, can be clunky, and you can have a lot of times where you just feel like you're, oh, I don't know what the rule is for this, or can we look this up, or I'm not sure. I never felt that way in this game, and someone just basically taught it to me just verbally, who was like someone who played it before, and we didn't even really have to, we had to look in the rule book for just a couple of things, but not too many. And I feel like after maybe two plays of it, you wouldn't even ever have to use the rule book. So I really liked how smooth it was and how I felt like the rules just worked in the game. So I liked that guy a lot. And did I win? No, I didn't win that game, I don't think. But, you know, I did help beat the bad guy, so I guess that was okay.
It is a moral victory.
I was Vargag, the Tundra Orc.
Oh.
Yeah, they got pretty fun names in the game.
Vargag.
Played some, we went to lunch after that and got some Subway. It was pretty good. Eat fresh, you know?
Eat fresh.
Yeah, that was pretty yummy. And then we set up for our big game of Rune Wars.
Yeah.
And Cody's going to talk about the first half of his game day, after lunch, we all sat down for a game of Rune Wars, which we hadn't played in a long time. And did you enjoy it?
I did. It was one of those where I hadn't played in a while. And it's kind of like every time I play Rune Wars, after I sit down and play a game, I'm like, I really like this game. Why don't I play this more?
That's because it's huge and takes a long time. It takes a long time to set up.
but it's, you know, the setup time's a little bit. But if you get people that know how to play, It's a 3 hour game tops.
Yeah, I mean, I think we had four people that played before, and I think we were just over three and a half hours.
It always ends more abruptly than I expect.
Yeah,
it's kind of like, oh,
because I think we were maybe at 3.5 hours, but we stopped in the middle to play ping pong games.
Oh yeah,
we were ping pong tournament. And we were walking around, so yeah, that was a lot of fun. Thanks to our buddy Dare for bringing that and pulling that guy out. So the rest of my afternoon was pretty much spent. Playing a game of Glory to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
We had to play a five-player game of that. Yogo Cody was in that one as well.
Yeah, I think I don't know if I prefer that with five. I think I really like it with two. I think four is the most I care to play with.
Yeah. I've never played with two, but you said it's really good
with two. It's really good with two.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to have to check that one out. But yeah, five seemed like just a little bit much. Plus, we had a few folks that were just learning the rules, and that's okay. It's going to take a little bit longer, but... But I think everybody had a pretty good time with that one. And the last thing that I played at the game night, or game day at that point, it was night. Sean Johnson, our buddy, brought out this game. Me, Sean, and Greg played Grimoire. Have you played this one?
I've not. Grimoire.
Yeah, so it's a game from Z-Man Games, and it's essentially a card game. Well, it's got some board game components to it, I guess. But it was kind of weird. The game comes with these little booklets that are your spell books. And I can't even tell you what exactly the flavor is what the point of the game is. But the point of the game is to get the most points. But you have these spell books, and every turn you cast a spell. And at the very beginning, you start out at like level 6. So you can only cast the first 6 spells. And eventually, every turn it goes up to, you get up to 15. And so you're looking in your spell book, and you find one that you want to do. And then there's a card called a bookmark. And you slide the bookmark in there, and then you lay down your spell book. And so everybody does that. Then you reveal your spell, and certain effects happen. And then the last part of the turn is just that you get to – that determines what the turn order is. And then you're going to take cards from these piles that are – there's a accomplice or assistant, or you know, a companion cards, things like that. And then you also have treasure cards. And the game ends when someone has gotten either 10 – I think it's companion cards, or 10 treasure cards, then you add up all the points. And the companion cards will give you different points and different money and things like that based upon, not money, points, based upon what order you went, if you went last or if you went first. So it's interesting. I'm not sure if I liked it that much, because I really felt like the spell casting part of it is... They didn't need to have a whole, like, a booklet.
Yeah.
You know, they could have put it on tokens or something, you know, or cards even.
Is the book cool, though?
It's okay. I didn't like the fonts in it. I thought the artwork
Look
was just...
Look at you.
I know, I'm getting snobby about that stuff, but I didn't find the artwork to be very cohesive. It seemed like the pictures on the cards were kind of anime almost, like dark anime, but then it just didn't, you know, I was expecting to see Comic Sans at some point, you know.
No, perish with that.
So it was all right. I believe that our buddy Greg completely destroyed me and Sean.
Yeah,
I think
looking
he won
at the
by
scoreboard,
like
yeah.
70 points or something. But so that one was kind of okay for me. But
yeah.
Anyway, that was my whole, other than ping pong, where I lost my first round match by 2 points to Greg. I think that was most of what I played.
I didn't even score 2 points in my opening. In
my
one, I lost 21-1.
Oh, not a ping pong person, are you?
So there you go. No.
Okay. No. I was pretty good back in when I first, right after I graduated from college, the first job that I ever had, I worked in a lab, and we had this ping pong table, and there was two labs, and there was like a warehouse in the middle where they kept supplies, and they just had a ping pong table set up. And so we would go out at lunchtime, and we played a lot. And so there's some guys there that were, I mean, really competitive about it. So I got pretty good, but it's been a few years
there
since
you
then.
Go.
So yeah. All right. So let's kind of rewind the tape here to the beginning of the game day. Tell us about your game day.
Okay, so I went with a similar approach that I did the Extra Life thing, where I played a lot of big games. I don't know how much I'll keep doing that, because it doesn't seem to be smart.
No, you didn't like it?
I liked it, but I think if I do, I should limit it to one. Because okay. I started the day with a game of Space Empires 4X.
Ooh.
Yep.
Good game.
A good game. I taught it to Sean and a guy named Ethan, and it was a three-player game. I still have only played three-player games of this. I've not played two. I've not played four. I've just played the three.
Oh, you know, that's that game's on my rundown too. I did because I forgot about the fact that prior to the game day, we had gotten together to play that game. So
yeah.
So go ahead. I like that one a lot, by the way.
Yeah. So we played. It was pretty much 4 hours on the dot with teaching. So I thought that went well. It was a pretty close back and forth game. We played with the variant. Pretty much how I've played all my games with the variant. 3 victory point rule versus because you know by the book you only win until someone takes over an opponent's home world, which I could see that going on for hours,
forever.
Hours.
Yeah.
But I'm still not sold on that variant though because I don't know it doesn't feel like a complete game to me
because you don't have if you do it that way you don't necessarily have to be confrontational, right? And isn't that kind of a part of
not necessarily game? Yeah. I think some confrontation will occur, but you don't have to be overtly, you know, confrontational.
Because the game that I played in that you and me and Dare played in, I was really close to winning that game, but I was exploring some area of space that was way far away from everybody else, but I never ran into any planets where I could put colonies.
Yeah.
And so that if I had found a planet, I would have won. So
yeah, I don't know. I think maybe with experienced players, the normal win condition would be fine, but I don't know.
He's got to be more aggressive if you're going for that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I'd be interested to try it.
You seem very conflicted.
Well, it's on one hand, I want to say, okay, I'll just play by the rules as written victory condition.
Yeah.
But then again, it's like, well, I don't want it to take 5-6 hours, you know?
Yeah, that's
true. I don't know. I think I just need to get a few people and try it. And then if it gets to a certain point and it's just a gridlock, then saying like, okay, this doesn't work.
Yeah. It's like TI3. It's like Twilight Imperium. You know, there's lots of tweaks and things.
But there's an expectation. Right? I mean, there you know what you're getting into. You know this is going to be an 8-hour game or whatever.
Yeah. And this is almost a big deal topic. But it's amazing to me that, you know, a game like Space Empires, it's more or less a hex encounter game, right? I mean, it's a little hex encounter game. Just little cardboard tokens. And then you got TI, which is mega chrome on it and all the miniatures and all that kind of stuff. And for some reason, a game with that much, this is just my opinion, a game with that much chrome as TI3, I feel like that's 6-hour game. Yeah, because I'm moving all this stuff around.
You get more bang for your 8 hours. Yeah.
But the idea of sitting for that long and just moving little chits around seems a bit much to me. Now, of course, that will probably lead into our war game discussion a little bit later on.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so go ahead.
Okay, I had brought Tumbling Dice, and that got quite a lot of people played that throughout the day.
Oh, hooting and hollering as always.
And it was. It's funny, when I wasn't playing big games, I played very quick pickup games of other things. Like, I played a lot of Tumbling Dice, I played a lot of Crokinole. Dare brought his really nice Helsinki board.
Oh,
and I was
beautiful.
Drooling over that. Mm-hmm. I love that thing. Let's see. Other games I play. We talked about our Rune Wars game.
Yep.
I'm not very good at it. I'm looking at the geek list that was put up.
And
if you check our Twitter and Facebook feeds, you can see it. Look at it for yourself.
You forgot what you played?
Kinda.
You played Glory to Rome.
I did play Glory to Rome.
You played Thunder Road.
Thunder Road. That's right. Yes.
Talk about Thunder Road.
Thunder Road is an old, I think it's a Milton Bradley game from the 80s that a few of our friends have, and it's just this Mad Max style, pure Ameritrash dice fest about gunning down other people's cars and trying to wreck them and avoid wrecks yourself. And it's a dumb but fun little game. Played that quite a bit. Let's see.
That might have been it, right?
That might have been it. Space Empires and Rune Wars, that was about 3/4 of my day.
Yeah.
I did play Can't Stop. You taught me that.
I did, yeah.
I enjoyed that. And I think that was it. I mean, I saw a lot of other games being played.
Oh, there was just a huge amount. And we had our friends Heather and Peter, who had just come back from their honeymoon at Essen, which is pretty awesome. And so they brought back a big pile of stuff. I think I saw them playing Drum Roll. Mm-hmm. And they had a copy of Nefarious, which is the other new game from DX Vaccarino.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to get an email from him saying, please don't call me DX. That's not my name.
Oh, you didn't know.
And so that was cool to have those games from them. But really, everybody seemed to bring a pile of games. It was just
48 unique games played.
Really?
By the list, yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So, and a lot of repeats on some stuff. We had the Dominion tournament. Do you know who won that?
I believe Sean did.
Really?
A little home cooking.
Who won the ping pong tournament? Brian won that guy.
Yes.
Right? But he beat Sean, right?
He beat Sean.
So it's interesting that Sean picked two games for the tournaments that are, that he was really good at.
Very interesting.
Huh. Okay.
Oh, I just thought of another game, speaking of Sean. To kick off the whole thing, I played Traitors of Carthage that we talked about last episode.
Oh, yeah. What'd you think of it?
I liked it. I got destroyed at it because I didn't really figure out the strategy until about halfway through.
It's tricky.
And as we'll talk about in the war game segment, I've played a lot of war games with Sean because a lot of them are two player and he's a big war game fan. And I need to find a game I'm really good at because pretty much every game I play with Sean,
he destroys you.
He destroys me because I'm usually trying to like figuring it out and I get it about halfway through, but by then I've been steamrolled. So
yeah, you know, at the game on game night, a few days prior to the game day, I played Blood Bowl Team Manager with Sean,
mm-hmm.
and he destroyed me by like 50 or 60 fans. It was really, really bad.
That game got a lot of play.
Yeah,
I think I saw that at least one copy at all times.
Yeah, there was new stuff being played. There was a lot of old stuff. They had someone played a game of the old original version of Titan.
Yes,
I don't think they necessarily finished it.
No,
but they did play it.
You don't ever finish a game of Titan.
No,
you try hard.
You start it and you try hard.
That's right. Someone brought Fortress America.
That's right. That's right.
The progenitor of the Ameritrash line.
Yeah, yeah. Josh said that he got that copy of Fortress America in a math trade or some kind of a trade.
Uh-huh.
And he traded for a copy of Descent that he had gotten on like Tanger or something for $45
nice.
Or $50. And so, I mean, that unpunched copy of that game is pretty amazing.
I'd like to play that one. It looked fun.
Yeah, yeah. So really, really cool. We just had such a good time. So
yeah,
we'll definitely do it again. We've had people suggest that we do it more than once a year, and I think that's a great idea to do it either quarterly or bi-yearly.
I think we could pull it off quarterly.
So maybe.
I mean, it was funny because everyone through the event kept coming to us and saying, oh, thanks for putting this on. I'm like, we didn't do anything. Thanks,
yeah,
Sean.
Thanks, you know? Sean. And, you know, and we just show up.
That's right. You know, we put our name on it and we show up.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the American dream.
So any other gaming or geekiness other than the game day?
No, not really. That pretty much dominated it. Big release is coming out this month. I'm hoping to get GameShare a copy of Eclipse.
Yeah.
You know, that'll be kind of a Jones Theory face-off because you have Space Empires, which is more kind of the old school thing.
Yeah.
And you have Eclipse, which kind of blends Euro mechanics into a 4X style game.
Yeah. And then you've got
Sid Meier's much sexier.
You got Sid Meier's Civ, which falls in that same category, right? So we got to kind of figure out which one of those three.
No.
No?
No.
Why?
Sid Meier's Civ. Now, come on.
You would the Space Empires beat Sid Meier's Civ? Is that what you're saying?
No, I kind of consider them two different things.
No, they're all 4X games. Sid Meier's Civ is totally a 4X game,
but not in space.
Oh, okay.
Buckets, my friend.
It's all about where you put the buckets on.
Besides, Through the Ages beats Sid Meier's Civ anyway.
Tricky. Okay.
But even bigger, Game of Thrones Second Edition. It's out now as we speak, and we got to play that before Christmas.
Okay,
that needs to be our goal.
That sounds fine to me.
I'm going to copy that.
As far as video games for me, I did buy a copy of Batman Arkham Asylum on your recommendation, and I'm only about 5% through the game, which for me is like 2 hours.
Yeah,
but I like it
lot. It's good, isn't it?
Oh, it's great. It doesn't give me. I have a real bad problem with. First-person shooter vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I can't really play. I used to play a lot of Halo 2
mm-hmm.
back when Halo 2 was out on the original Xbox. But I've gotten to this point where I can only play a first-person shooter for about half an hour, and then I start feeling sick to my stomach. I don't know what has caused that. It's very strange. But this game, being that it's mainly primarily third-person, there's some parts that are first-person, but I haven't had any trouble with it at all, and I just love the kind of stuff that you can do. It takes all of the things that I didn't like about other kinds of games and it makes them better.
Hmm.
Like Splinter Cell, games like that are stealth games, right? Metal Gear Solid and those kind of games. I liked the idea of those games, but I was terrible at them and I got so frustrated every time, you know, I couldn't sneak by the guard mm-hmm. and, you know, I do that 50 times and just don't want to play anymore. But the way they do stealth in Batman is really cool.
Yeah.
It's a little more forgiving, I think, you know. And so, having the gargoyles up there that you can, you know, shoot up onto sometimes, I think that's pretty cool.
It's a very good game.
Go ahead. No, I insist.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say I am fully delved into Skyrim, and it is phenomenal.
Is it good?
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Wow. Okay.
I'm taking my time with it. I'm not as with most Elder Scrolls game, I'm not really far along in the main story, but uh-huh. I'm having fun doing all the side quests, and I'm a werewolf, so that's cool.
is there multiplayer in this, or is it mainly just a single player game?
In Skyrim?
Yeah.
No, it's single player.
Okay. Well, just because so many games that come out now, that ends up being one of the big draws of it, like, you know, Call of Duty and that kind of stuff is multiplayer, but
no,
it's just for single player.
Yep.
Okay. Well, cool. I don't think there's any other geekery things that I've been participating in.
I need to get back to reading Dresden.
You're still kind of stuck on book two?
I've not really had time to read, so.
I haven't done much reading either, but I've been listening to quite a number of podcasts. And we don't usually do a whole lot of plugging of other podcasts on this show, but I listen to quite a few. And check out the Dice Tower's recent episode where they had Rich Sommer on that show.
Mm-hmm.
Rich Sommer is an actor from the show Mad Men, which is one of my very favorite television shows of all
time. How many episodes do you think Tom and Eric combined have watched of Mad Men? That doesn't seem like it'd be up their alley.
I think it's got to be.
I'll set it at 1.5, over or under.
Over, but just barely, okay. Maybe. Okay. Probably did some research pre-show. Who knows? Yeah. But no, it was a really good episode. And Rich is a kind of a cool guy that is a total full-on gamer, but then also a Hollywood actor. So that's kind of neat.
Bowtie aficionado in the show.
In the show, yeah. But he's also got some really cool stuff that he's doing on the G4 network, where the show Attack of the Show, which is kind of a video game show, he's doing a board game segment on that show now. And he's done a couple of them now, you know, going over, you know, the games that are, you know, the games that we love, things like Pandemic, and he did one on Quarriors and that kind of stuff. So I would check that one out. And also, I've been listening to this new podcast. It's not new. It's been around for about a year and a half, called The Nerdist,
mm-hmm.
which is I was talking to Cody about this earlier, that it's a really good podcast. It is not a family friendly podcast. I'll go ahead and say that. It's got some explicit language in it and everything. So don't listen with that one if that's not your thing. But they have really good interviews with a lot of sort of geek celebrities and things like that. They've got you know, like people from the Big Bang Theory and that kind of stuff. It's hosted by a guy named Chris Hardwick, who's really quite funny. But I noticed that The Nerdist seems to be kind of like the hipster nerds, you know? Like, we're the gaming, we don't even really call ourselves nerds, really. It's more like geeks, I guess. Mm-hmm. But these guys seem like they'd still be drinking their foamy lattes and wearing skinny jeans, you know, but they're also Star Trek fans, you know? Yeah. but it's really good content on that show, so I would check it out. But that's all I got, man. That's the whole rundown. Are you done?
I'm done.
Well, let's go and make some war.
Let's.
So once again, it's time to broaden our gaming horizons. Are you ready to have them broadened?
I am ready to be broadened. Or to begin the broadening process.
Okay.
I'm going to broad that ship, as it were, instead of board that ship.
I don't understand what you're saying at this
point. War games.
Okay, war games. We have, as common gamers, branched off into many different areas of gaming away from our normal
our comfort zones
of board games and RPGs. We've tried lots of different things, and one area of gaming that we haven't really gotten around to talking about yet is war games. And so we want to just talk a little bit about our foray into war gaming, and we've only really, I think, dipped our toe into the water a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I don't think we've really gone full fledged into the, what was that game that we had a listener write in about?
World in Flames.
World in Flames. It was like 60 hours to play or something. Yeah,
I think like 100 hours to
play. Okay, well, we have not played that game.
No, not yet.
But we got a chance to play a few games, and we just want to talk about our impressions of war games. And you know, I think that one thing that has always been daunting to me about war games is the length, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's very similar to my feeling about things like miniatures games, you know, length and complexity and investment and all that kind of stuff. In this case, an investment of time, whereas with miniatures, it's more of an investment of money and, well, also time, but, you know, and things like that. So, and for me, war games have never been very appealing because of the component quality, I guess.
They don't draw you in, especially a lot of the hex and counter games. It's just, you know, because of the length, they need to sacrifice some aesthetic quality just for simplicity and components, and, you know, to keep it a respectable price.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to, you're not going to have a bunch of little plastic tanks when you could just have a little cardboard counter.
Right. Now, there have been games that, you know, branch away from this, there are miniatures war games that are historical, like Flames of War is one that mimics World War II. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of other ones. And no matter, when you go to Gen Con, it's always fun to see games that folks have made that are like, you know, airplanes that are on top of like antenna that, you know, will raise and lower and all this kind of stuff. I always find that the people that play those games tend to be a lot of older folks, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of usually older men who you even see some that have the baseball cap on with like, you know, name of a ship or something, like, you know, they were actually mm-hmm. veterans, you know. So I was kind of wondering, this one thing I wanted to talk about is one of the main draws of wargaming a military background? Because I know my dad was in the Navy and my grandfather was a career Navy, but I wouldn't say that I have a military background. I didn't have that indoctrinated into me.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think some interest is kind of required, because it's like with a lot of Euro games and Ameritrash games, you know, it's like if you play Survive, you don't really have to have an interest in island survival and Atlantis and things like that. You know, it's just a theme. Oh, I'll knock this out an hour and a half and play it. You know, be done. But these war games, especially some of the more complex ones or the more scenario-based ones, it's kind of, you know, if you don't know a lot of the World War II battles or what really happened, then it's harder for you to really kind of get connected with it.
Yeah, so I think being a history buff is if you are a history buff, then, and especially a war history buff, mm-hmm. that can really draw you into games like this.
Yeah. And to, on your comment about kind of the older folks, something I was going to mention was that it's almost like there was this golden age of wargaming, kind of, uh-huh. you know, like the 60s and 70s. That was your golden age of wargaming. You know, what eventually became D&D started as a war game.
Oh, that's true. The technical miniatures game, mm-hmm. Historical, right?
Yeah. So they did it. Well, it wasn't really historical, but it was a miniatures game.
Okay.
And then, you know, they made their rules, I believe it was for more of like a squad-based skirmish thing, you know, so you could have like individual, you know, this is a knight instead of this, you know, this counter is, you know, 20 knights, you know. I'm going to just command this one character. And then they wanted to explore the rules. What would happen if he goes in this city or goes in this thing? And then it just spun into, you know, what is now the role-playing game. But, you know, you had the 60s and 70s where wargaming is king. And that's where you have a lot of the Avalon Hill titles and a lot of just the classics of the genre. I wonder if it's kind of fading out or if it's coming back, you know?
Well, I think it's changing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that what is considered a war game may be changing also. I mean, you almost really, as part of the discussion, ask the question, what is a war game?
Is a war game?
Well, okay. I mean, at its basic level, I guess it's any game that is about some sort of military conflict, you mm-hmm. know? And I think that I tend to think of it more in terms of actual historical military combat. Now, some people would say that games like Battle Lore would be a war game, you know, and I guess it has war game-esque mechanics, you know, card-driven mm-hmm. mechanics, but I don't think that it's you know, I don't think of it as a war game because it's not historical.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, like Starfleet Battles or Federation Commander, you know.
Yeah.
Some people consider those war games because it's got the hex encounters and it has the charts and it has kind of that crunchy war game feel. But it's, you know, it's ships in space. It's like, to me, I think more people categorize that as a Star Trek game or a space game instead of a war game, when it's probably closer to a war game.
Right. Well, because I think it's our own perspectives on what war is. You know, I mean, especially in the United States, we have a history of, you know, hundreds of years of many different wars, you know, many people who have lost their lives in those wars. And this is where I think wargaming is very different from other kinds of gaming, is that it's someone who has put together a game to simulate an actual conflict that happened in the real world with real people, you know, who shed their blood and died, you mm-hmm. know. And I think that's, you mentioned that, you know, the evolution of role-playing games kind of came out of that. And I wonder almost if, you know, the role-playing element of it was just due to maybe a side effect of the fact that you don't see World War II role-playing games, do you?
Yeah, not many, if there's any out there. Yeah,
none that I know of that are popular, you know. Because, I mean, who would really... It's like you don't want to step into those shoes, you know. Yeah. I mean, those were real men, you know, and real people. And, you know, to step into that and to role-play that is just too much, you know. Yeah. It would be kind of weird and maybe disrespectful, you know, depending on your feelings about things. But to remove role-playing element,
that personal connection,
yeah, and just put it as just pieces on a board, you know, mm-hmm. maybe that's almost a reason for some of the minimalistic pieces, you know, is that, you know, it's just it's like those old movies where you're you know, they're talking about the, they're doing the strategy about where they're going to, you know, they have little figures. Mm. I always think about, well, I think like Battlestar Galactica when they had like the you know,
stuff in the war room.
Yeah. And they're using the croupier's stick to like move things around, you know, that it's very, you're very much removed from the personal element of it, you know?
Well, and another aspect is that, as Americans, you know, not so much today, cause we're kind of just we're a more bitter people. We're more cynical people than we would say 1950. You know,
agreed.
And you have that kind of veneer in the 40s and 50s, especially post-war stuff, where it was just this very romanticized things in a lot of ways. You know, when you're not really getting into the individual stories, but you know, it's like the good guys triumphed, democracy and the people, you know,
right.
came in. You know, it's a flag waving thing. You're coming in, and you don't really think about the horrors of war and people losing limbs and things like that. But
yeah.
So it's kind of on some degree, that's War Games presents that. I don't know. It's just like you're commanding an army, and you don't have to think real hard about, you know, the personal aspects of war.
Right, right. And I think that one of the traits of War Games that you definitely see is complexity. Now, we're going to talk in a few minutes about Maneuver. We're going to be doing a review, which is a lot on the simpler end of war game mechanics, and that's by no means a dig on that game, as you'll see. But you know, if you take some of the granddaddies of war games today, when I say granddaddies, the ones that are popular today, Combat Commander Europe is one of the most popular war games that's out right now. It came out in 2006, and that is a game that has an enormous amount of complexity to it, and you know, has a lot of things that are really trying to simulate the reality of what would have been going on, things like the fog of war and you know, the uncertainty and supply chains and things like that. It's you know, war games tend to bridge this gap between abstraction and simulation, you know, and I think that there's almost a gradient of war games where you have the more simplified ones where they have a lot more abstraction, and then you have the crunchier ones at the other end that are really trying to almost be a simulation of the battle.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It seems like it's just this one fixed sliding scale that you cannot deviate from. You know, you have, say, you have Memoir 44 on one end where it's abstraction, and you have what's one of the big like Hex Encounter kind of World War II games?
World in Flames.
I don't know if that's a World War II game, but shoot, I just spaced on it. But there are some that are just these crunchy, you know, take multiple hours, and you play long campaigns. And
like we said, we've only dipped our toe in the water.
Like
so
Advanced Squad Leader. That's
of course the ASL. One. Yeah,
So you know, it just seems like everything has to be on that scale. You can't have a really abstracted yet complicated, crunchy game.
Right, and it seems like the more abstraction that you put into there, the lighter the game tends to get. You know, and so it's just sort of whatever flavor of game you like there, and that's why I feel like this whole love of history and the actual, you know, historical elements that go behind the wars really helps you to get more involved in those complicated games. You know, because for me, I'm a big time history buff, but not so much war or military history.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I've played with guys who are heavy war gamers that they can tell you about exact kinds of tanks and the, you know, this gun was only on this kind of airplane, you know, and they just know so much detail about it, you know, to the point where they get a little bit snarky about, you know, well, this rule doesn't make any sense because there's no way that those tanks would be able to do this right. and that, you know, and they start to get, you know, a little snobby about it, I guess.
But, so I was going to ask, so what would be your favorite wargaming era if you had to pick one?
I mean, I think my favorite era is probably the Civil War, although I don't know of too many games. I mean, Battle Cry is one of Richard Bork's Commands and Colors games that's very light, that's in that genre. One that I actually haven't had a chance to play.
There's the new Test of Fire, Bull Run.
Yeah, Bull Run, Test of Fire is another one that's that one just came out as a Martin Wallace game from Mayfair. And so I really like that that genre quite a bit. I think it's because when I was in school, I studied the Civil War quite a bit. I grew up in Virginia, and so there was lots of battles and history.
I'm surprised you call it the Civil War.
We don't sit around calling it the War of Northern Aggression, if that's what you're thinking.
I know some Southerners that war is never civil.
Well, living in Virginia was a really strange thing because we never get credit for being the South. You know, it's like, you're kind of East Coast, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we're not really getting credit for being East Coast so much or being Southern. It's just sort of, but, you know, I always point out that, you know, Richmond, Virginia was the capital of the mm-hmm. Confederacy. And so there's a whole lot of Civil War stuff going on there. So that's interesting to me. Ken Burns' Civil War documentary is one of my favorites. Best. Yeah. Yep. But anyway, what about you? I mean, do you have a particular era?
I'm a military history buff up until the 20th century. Like I really enjoy Revolutionary War stuff. I really enjoy Civil War stuff, but I don't really enjoy World War I and II and beyond that. Just I don't know why. I've never gotten into it. You know, it's like I know a lot more about the military history of, say, the American Revolution than I do World War II. It's like I know more. You know, we're both pretty big history buffs. I know the general kind of global story of World War II and, you know, the specifics and things. But like the specific military conflicts, I don't know as much about. I know probably equal to or maybe a little more than the average guy, but nothing compared to a lot of these war gamers. So yeah. I'd say either Revolutionary War or non-specific kind of like, you know, old, you know, like knights and stuff sort like of thing.
More ancient.
Yeah.
Well, not like ancient, but
like Middle Ages, or like sieges and things like that, you know.
Okay, yeah.
So.
And one nice thing is I think that the war game industry that's out there, there really are designers who are making games in all of these different eras. So you have everything from the Crusades mm-hmm. to even going up to the game Labyrinth that just came out a couple years ago, which is about the war on terrorism. Yeah. You know?
And it's controversial because a lot of people are kind of too soon.
Too soon, yeah. But really brings up another point regarding war games is how far is too far as the simulation or the topics that you're choosing, the kind of things that you would put in there. But
yeah,
how do you feel about that?
I don't know. I mean, it's a lot like what we were talking about earlier. You know, I don't think, you know, if someone's playing Germany in a World War II game, you know, I really don't think they're taking on the aspects of Nazi Germany and all that. You know, it's like, I think we can assume that.
Well, this brings up an issue of Memoir 44 from a few years ago. I don't know if we mentioned this on the show before, but I played in a Memoir 44 Overlord game.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about this.
At Origins, at least two, maybe 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I was playing on the Allied side with I think Eric Sommer and a couple other folks. Tom Vassell was, I think, running the game, possibly. It's been a few years, but it was definitely some Dice Tower folks that were doing it. And then on the other side of the table, one of the gentlemen who was playing the Nazi forces, the German forces, was wearing like a I don't know the name of it, but like
it's like an SS helmet, like a Nazi sort of thing.
Like a hat.
Yeah.
And I snapped a picture of us playing this game, you know, and put it on Board Game.
And this is like an officer's hat. It's not like a ball cap with a swastika.
No. It's just like an officer's cap. Yeah. And I wasn't even taking a picture because of the hat. I just took the picture because this is the game I'm playing in.
It was a big Overlord game. A lot of people play.
Here's all the guys that I'm playing with, and you know, and I posted it on Board Game Geek, and it got like, you know, the little thumbs you can do there. It got like 150 thumbs or something like that. Or, you know, I think a lot of people thought that was cool with the hat. But then the comment thread that went below that was just full of just all of this vitriol over the fact that he wore this hat. I mean, and it got really to the point where they had to lock the thread.
Yeah, I know.
Like the monitors came in and locked it because the people were getting so upset over it. You know,
I remember I was traveling for the holidays. I think it was over like a Thanksgiving holiday or some sort of holiday. I wasn't in town, and you just sent me a link and you were just like, oh my god, what is happening?
Because I posted the picture and then I didn't like subscribe to it, I wasn't getting any updates about it, and then I happened to notice it was on the top pictures, like, you know, they have a little thing where it shows the top pictures, and I'm like, oh, that's my picture, and oh crap. So anyway, so there can be some emotion attached to these games, and you know, how much simulation, how much abstraction do you want to put into games? I mean, I think if you look at video games, a game like Call of Duty, the whole Call of Duty series, which is wildly popular, you know, people don't seem to have any problem with the video game part of things. You know, I'm gonna be an American soldier and mow down some, you know, nondescript
enemies.
You know, so anyway,
it's tricky. I mean, you know, it's kind of if you you know, if you step away from the Call of Duty sort of thing, and if you're a complete outsider, like if you were visiting from another planet, you know, yeah. you might look at that and really like, that's very bizarre. You know, people are dying and, you know.
Right. And this is the way that people are having fun, you know.
Yeah. But in a way, you know, but I don't take the attitude of, oh, those monsters, you know, how can you do that? Yeah. You know, I'm playing. You know, I say I'm playing a game like Skyrim. It's not historically accurate or anything, but you know, I'm hacking people's like limbs off and right. you know all sorts of manner of ill things. But you kind of don't stop and think about, oh, you know.
Now, one of the things that I think is very cool about the way that a lot of war game mechanics are put together is the fact that, like I said, we've removed ourselves from the emotion of it, you know, so it seems almost more like a chessboard, you know, mm-hmm. you have your pieces, I have my pieces, and we're going to see who can, you know, battle it out. And so it really becomes a strategic game of, you know, where am I going to put my guys? Am I going to hide behind this? Am I going to go around here? What objective am I going to go for? In a game like I mentioned, you know, Combat Commander Europe, it's very interesting how they have an objective chit pull at the beginning of the game where you have an open objective that both players will look at. Like it'll, each map has different numbers on different hexes, you know, the 1 through 5 or something like that. And you'll pull this random chit out and it'll say, if you control objective number or hex number 5, then you get 3 victory points, you know. So both players are going to be going for that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then each player will select a secret objective. And, you know, that could be any number of things, you know, controlling a different area or might have some other thing that you have to do to get points. And so you have this open objective that's sitting there, but then you also have secret objectives that you don't know, you know, why is he going for number 4 there, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think it creates some uncertainty in the game that helps to simulate war quite well. So I like the fact that war games, you know, really become almost like a chess game, you know, as far as you're outsmarting one another. It isn't so much about physical force or firepower or anything. It's, you know, partially that because of the way the stats are in the game, but it's about outthinking your opponent, you know, like you feel like you're a general controlling an entire army, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that's kind of a fun aspect of those kind of games. Now, as far as the distribution of these games, you know, there's a few companies that are specialized in war games. We mentioned Advanced Squad Leader, which is a game that has been around. Well, it came out as first as Squad Leader and then Advanced Squad Leader. And now I believe they have the Advanced Squad Leader Starter Kit, mm-hmm. which is only a, you know, 19-hour experience that's instead right. of a, you know, 55-hour experience. And that it can help you get involved in that game a little bit more. That's one that I have not had the opportunity to play, even in its simplest form. Probably one I need to find a local player of if I ever wanted to.
Yeah,
you know, learn about that guy. It's not high on my list.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking, you know, we were talking about these eras of history. The war games have expanded to the point where I find it funny you can play a what's classified as a war game, you know, on the Protestant Reformation. You know, it's like yeah. you know, I'm controlling the forces of Martin Luther and I'm going to take it to those Catholics. It's like, what?
Okay.
It's like, that's interesting.
And so one of the great things about modern war games that, you know, you can play in so many different genres. And one of the companies that is very much, I guess I would consider them kind of the leader in war game production these days is GMT Games. And they have a very interesting system that if you listen to our show last time on Kickstarter, you know, we mentioned the P500 program. And this is a pre-order program for GMT Games where they have all these different war games that have been designed, and you know, it's basically almost kind of a print on demand thing. Like, you know, when they hit their goal of 500 pre-orders, then that triggers the publishing of the game. Mm-hmm. And so that's really cool because it's really, I think, driven by the fans, you know, that whatever cream is rising to the top in war games, that's what's going to get made.
Yeah, it's 100% demand. So,
yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you know, that's one of the cool ways that those games can get produced. And I also think it might be a reason why we don't see the high, super high component quality.
Yeah.
You know, now GMT games, they always have very nice cards. I mean, they're always good quality cards. The boards are usually paper or kind of a thin cardboard, mm-hmm. you know, and then you have all the cardboard chits. Now, Cody is turning into a cardboard chit.
I'm a counter clipper.
Counter clipper.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That's just, so a lot of these have these kind of square cardboard counters, and the corners of which can become kind of frayed because you're taking them, usually punch them out of a cardboard sheet. I mean, some of the really OCD people cut them out of the sheet. They don't even punch them out. But okay. I punch them out. But I like clipping the corners. So imagine a square, but like the corners just kind of barely clip. So it kind of makes, I don't know how I would describe it.
It's like an octagon with really short corner sides.
Yeah. So, and people, there's all, if you look on the board, on Board Game Geek, it's funny because people offer reasons from like, it's more hygienic, and I don't get there. Like, well, less dirt gets in the corner. I'm like, oh, okay, no, I don't think so. Some people say it's, it makes the counters last longer. I just think it looks better. I don't like the little frayed edges, so I'm kind of anal and I punch them all, because I think they look really good when everything's clipped on the board.
See, and it's, every gamer has their thing, right? Mm-hmm. So there's the sleever, there's the guy who's going to paint all the miniatures in their game, and then for someone whose main games just have cardboard tokens in them, they're going to clip them. So you even have like
I got a little jig.
You got a thing that, that's pretty impressive. So, so component quality, not really the thing. Here, it's the rule set. So these games are going to have a lot of times charts, that you're going to have to look at during the game. They're going to have possibly dice, maybe not, like I keep mentioning Combat Commander Europe, that game does not have dice at all. It has cards that have dice on them. So whenever you have to roll the dice, you flip over a card and you look at that, and that's your 2d6 roll. But then you look at a game like Memoir 44, which came out back in 04, 05, something like that.
That sounds about right.
Yep. And this was a game that I think probably sent the wargaming community into a little bit of a tizzy. I'm just guessing here. It's not like I've looked on any forums, but I have seen a lot of discussion about, is Memoir 44 a war game or not? Now, by my definition, is it a game about war? And yes, then it is. But it is, we talked about abstraction versus simulation. It's so far down in the abstraction category that, I mean, what do you think about
it? Yeah, Matt? We've
heard your opinions about Memoir falling in your a falling star in your sky.
Yeah, it's pretty much crashed at this point. But,
oh, no.
But I guess I would still consider it a war game, because I use about the same definition as you. I consider it more, and this might ruffle some feathers, I consider it more of a war game than, say, like Twilight Struggle. Twilight Struggle is not a war game to me.
No, I don't.
It seems completely different.
That's up for a debate too.
But back to me, it's a very, 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 very light war game. I mean, I played a game with Sean Johnson. He's the one who facilitates our Game On Game Night. I've played a few with him because he's a big war game guy, and I've been wanting to try some, and he destroys me. I think he must think I'm like learning deficient because it's just like I'm so terrible at war games. But anyway, we played a really light, like 10-minute war game called Tank on Tank, which it's this little hex encounter thing. You can pack it in your lunch bag and play it at work. I think it's more of a war game than Memoir is. I mean, Memoir is just very, it's so abstracted. It's kind of, I don't know. But
I feel like that game, it pays homage to the different battles. Like, I think they went into a lot of detail about when you set the scenarios up of, here's who was fighting. It was the French Resistance or the British Special Forces or whatever. And, I think they tipped a hat to all of those things. But as far as how it plays out, I mean, some of the way the rules work doesn't make a lot of sense realistically. Yeah.
When an infantry unit gets down to the last man, and I know infantry units aren't four-man squads, but if you take that abstraction and they're down to nothing at all, and they're taking out whole squads of tanks.
Yeah,
I'm like, come on,
that's going a bit far. Yeah. So I mean, what's some of the other war games that you've played? I know you had a chance to play a couple of different ones with Sean.
Yeah, so I mentioned Tank on Tank. That one's fun, if not really expensive. I think it's like $35 or something. I mean, he got it in a trade because it's kind of ridiculously overpriced.
Wow.
I played Hammer of the Scots. It even made my top 11. That's one I want to play more because it's neat because it doesn't so much have like the hex encounter thing. It has, it's blocks, and it's not really hex. It's a map of Northern England and Scotland, and it's about the Wars of Scottish Independence. That's a period I really like. I'm a big Scottophile, so I enjoy that. But it's nice because it's got a mix of the fog of war aspect, as well as kind of that medieval combat thing. Like in the winter, you have to go back to a castle. You can't just hang out in Scotland for the winter because you'll freeze. But it's also not a 3-hour game. Most games are going to be an hour, maybe two.
Nice.
And it's kind of fun. The blocks are neat, and I like that. So that was a good one. Washington's War I've played. That is, you know, I mentioned I'm a big Revolutionary War buff. That one played a lot more like Twilight Struggle than I thought it would.
Okay.
Like, there's definitely some combat and some skirmishing in there, but a lot of it is so controlled by influence. And, you know, it's basically, you know, the British player wins if they control X colonies. The American player wins if they control X colonies. And so much of that is driven by you just putting influence tokens, kind of like Twilight Struggle. So that one was interesting. I'd play it again. It gets a little on the two Twilight Struggle side for me. It's like, I really like Twilight Struggle, but like I said, I don't consider that a war game so much. So if I want a war game experience,
and I would agree with you, I don't really consider that a war game either, because it's more of just a fight for.
That's like influence. A heavy two player strategy game.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And so imagine so Washington's War is kind of like Twilight Struggle, but imagine there is some military aspect, like you have generals and armies moving around. But not a lot.
Uh-huh.
Not a ton. So,
okay.
There's that. Let's see. We've played A Few Acres of Snow.
Right. And that's the kind of a new one with some different mechanics to it. You know, there's the hex encounter thing. There's the card-driven systems like Hannibal Rome versus Carthage and Combat Commander Europe. Was Washington's War, is that
Washington's War is card-driven.
Yep. Okay. So a lot of card-driven war games come out recently. And then you have A Few Acres of Snow, which also plays with cards, but this one plays unlike any war game I've ever played before.
Yeah.
It's because it has a little bit of a deck building aspect to it. It's not strictly a deck building game, but you're going to be using cards to move things around and to take over things. And I really like that one a lot. That's the game about the French and Indian War or the Hundred Years War.
Seven years. Wow. American history on.
The Seven Years War. Wow, I look stupid. Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, that one I need to play a few more times. I could see that not feeling very wargamey after a while, just because, I don't know, it seems like the hexes and the counters make it more wargamey. I know that seems weird, but, you know, you're just trying to get these, you know, I forget what the exact things are, but, you know, after a while, it just comes down to victory points.
Yeah.
In that game, you know. So.
Yeah, yeah, because it's not about just taking over.
Yeah, it's not like, you know. It's not this just open-ended thing where it's like, well, if you take over the city, you win, or if you take over the city, you win. Or it's a specific scenario, because after a certain point, it's just like, okay, the game's over, and you count up how many victory points.
Yeah, but it's Wallace. I think that's probably where that comes from a little bit. Surprised there wasn't a poverty aspect of the game.
A few other ones I play. Like I said, I've played Starfleet Battles and Federation Commander, whether you consider that a war game. That's tough for me. I mean, because it's not a real war, but you know,
but it's got the battle aspect.
It's you know, it's take the Star Trek universe and mesh it with like the BSG universe. You know, if Star Trek was all about fighting and not about exploration and bettering humanity and all that. So,
well, what about? I mean, I didn't think about this. What about games like Risk and Axis and Allies?
I can hear the war gamers just squirming out there. But you know, I would say Risk is a very kind of light war game. And Axis and Allies, it gets a lot of heat. I've never really played it. It gets a lot of heat from the war game community. I don't think many true war gamers, air quote, like it. But
yeah.
I would consider it a war game, sure.
But, I mean, any aspect of gaming, you end up with your people who want to build high walls as to what is and what is not.
It's the effing gamers thing. But, you know, I've not played Axis and Allies. You know, I've played Risk when I was younger, and yeah, I'm going to play Risk Legacy here soon.
Oh, yeah. Looking forward to that guy.
But yeah, they're all war games. They're light. You know, they're not ASL. But
they all simulate military conflict.
Exactly.
You know, and one game that I had a chance to play with the designer very recently is a game called Engage, which is, I really think, really takes war game mechanics and sort of turns them on their side a little bit by adding some Euro resource management aspects to it at the same time.
They were running demos of this at the game on game day. It looked
they
really
were,
cool.
Yeah. Jack came down from Table Tactics Games and ran some games of that. And so it's a two-player game, but the board itself is you know, basically kind of a barren area. But then you also have in the middle these objectives that you're trying to control. I forget what they are. They're like bunkers or something like that. But you're trying to control them. And you have these little pieces that represent more or less different kinds of guns. Like the pieces themselves look like guns on a stand, just the gun, and they have different attack ratings and everything, and there's a whole, like many war games, there's a big chart that tells you what these things can do and what they can't do and what their special abilities are and all that. But then, you know, you're able to move pieces in and you're trying to take over control of these bunkers, but what you're going to be using to do things in this game is a resource called skill. And so you have this on the board, a little marker that's showing how much skill you have. And so you have to basically expend a certain amount of that skill to be able to overtake somebody. And so there's kind of a math aspect to it, but then there's also bluffing, because you're going to choose how much skill you want to spend behind a shield, and you basically are kind of staring down your opponent there. And when the time comes, you reveal how much skill you used and whether you're able to accomplish what you wanted to accomplish. And, and once you are out of skill, you're out of skill, and the only way you get skill back is by losing pieces. And that you'll actually gain skill back when you lose pieces. So it's this very back and forth of trying to figure out how you're going to manage all these resources. And it still has that war game aspect to it, but it feels more like a Euro game to me, and that's by no means a dig on it. That's a cool thing, but that's just a different flavor of war game. I really enjoyed Engage. That's a new one that just came out recently. So overall, what do we have to say about war games here? As far as we've tried a few of them. I mean, are you someone, the ones that you've tried?
Mm-hmm.
Are you in on this now, or are you? Is this not something that you're going to want to continue to play?
I think I'm in insofar as like the ground floor. Like, I don't think I'm really rushing out there to play ASL or Case Blue or anything like that. I'm not really good at war games. I'm not good at dudes on a map games. I'm just don't have the skill for that. But I enjoy it. Like, I really enjoy Federation Commander, and I enjoyed Washington's War and Hammer of the Scots, and those games especially. So I think I like it in the small containable scenario, like the 1 or 2 hour sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I'd like to try with Federation Commander is I like the idea of campaigns in war games, because I like the idea where battles matter and that where retreat is an option. Because a lot of the ones I've seen for Federation Commander, you might do this ongoing Federation Klingon thing, right? And it's not just, you can just throw your ships at each other, but if you lose those ships, and you can't use it later on in the campaign. So It's you're fighting over objectives, but if the cost gets too high, you can warp out of there and just say, okay, we got to regroup here. And based on how well you do in each campaign, that changes the stakes for later on. If the Klingons are doing really well, then maybe they have more ships and they're trying to siege a starbase or something, and then you have to defend it. That's the idea of war games I can really get behind, is campaign play. It's just sitting down and just doing like the, I'm going to do Omaha Beach for the 86th time. It's like, well, this kind of very contained thing. I would rather do this extended campaign about that and the whole D-Day, liberation of Paris and all that. I think that would be more interesting. So the spark is there, I think. I'm willing to try more. I'm not completely shut out on them.
Yeah.
What about you?
I'm probably more close to being shut out on them. And I think the reason is just because, as I may have said many times before, I'm not very good at games.
No.
I love games, but I'm not very good at them.
And you try hard.
I do try very hard.
Maybe you and I need to play war games.
So you can win?
So I can win.
Okay.
And I can wear the little, officer the little cap German or something.
Yeah, get right. Yelled at. But I think it's because I find myself in deep strategy games like that, where you're having to plan out a bunch of stuff, that I just watch my strategy just crumble. It just happens more often than not that I thought that I had a good thing going, and I didn't think about this, or I didn't think about that, and I just find that there's other folks that just think better than me in those aspects of games, and I just get crushed every time. And that's true in most games, but in war games, I just feel like there's just so much to keep track of in most of these games that it's very difficult to. It's difficult for me to have fun with those. Not that I have to win to have fun, but I like to feel like I'm in it,
Yeah, if you're just getting crushed all the time, it gets kind of...
Right. So maybe I just need to, get better at games.
Practice.
Be better at games. But, one war game that we really did enjoy quite a bit that we got a chance to play recently that's on that lighter side, but one that you might want to check out is Maneuver. Yeah. And I say we do... What? What were you going to say?
No, I say let's talk about it.
Oh, what a great idea. Thanks.
You're listening to Game On with Cody and John. This podcast goes to an 11 on a 20-sided die.
Shall we play a game?
Oh.
I think I missed him.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Love to. How about global thermonuclear war?
Wouldn't you prefer a good game of chess?
Later. Let's play global thermonuclear war.
Fine.
All right.
So, maneuver. This is a game with many vowels. It's M-A-N-O-E-U-V-R-E. It's a battlefield combat game, early 19th century warfare. This one is from GMT Games, which we mentioned quite a bit before as being the producer of all kinds of war games. Mm-hmm. So, then they also produced Space Empires.
They did. You could call that a war game. Well, you might.
You could.
You might.
Okay.
As the inbox
fills up with emails about war games.
Cold War, CIA versus KGB simulates military combat in a card situation. So it obviously is a war game.
Of course it's a war game.
delete.
The Dungeon Run is a war game. It's got fighting in it,
Settlers
right?
Settlers of Catan, Hex, Counters.
There you go. Perfect. Okay. Everything's a war game today. So in this game, it's kind of a skirmish game. It's got a small number of units in it, but it's played on a very small board. The game consists of all of these 4x4 square tiles, and you're going to use four of them to make a 8x8 square for the game. So it's different every time that you set it up. And the game comes with a rather large stack of these tiles, so you can set it up different every time. In addition, the game is going to come with eight different armies. You get the Austrians, you get France, Great Britain, the Ottoman Empire, the Prussians, the Russians, Spain, and the United States.
USA.
Yeah. And so that's, I think, really impressive in one game to get that many different options. And that's just a lot of replayability already right there. Mm-hmm. And every army is going to play a little bit differently. Every army is going to have a certain number of cardboard tokens. And these are, I would say, bigger than your average hex encounter.
These are double size.
Yeah, they're double size hexes. And so nice and thick, really good artwork on them, and very colorful. And you're going to set these guys up on the board, one side of one country on one side, one country on the other, and then you're going to go at it. And the turn is very, very simple. And really, the way that you're trying to win this game is there's two ways to win. You can win what's called an attrition victory, which is where you kill five or more enemy units. Or you can have what's called a nightfall victory, and that's where they say the day ends. You know, every army has a deck of cards that's played with it, and when both players have completely gone through their deck, then the first person to run through their deck gets to reshuffle as many times as needed. But when both people have gone completely through their deck, then that's considered the end. You count up victory points based upon who's destroyed the most stuff.
Because it's 19th century combat, so it's when the day's over, there's really not much more fighting.
I guess we gotta go home, exactly. And I wonder how that actually worked, It's like, okay, guys, I guess we'll see you tomorrow. I don't know. I guess they retreated or something, or...
I didn't
think they'd be fighting in the middle of the night, right?
No.
Couldn't have done that, so...
Nothing to see by.
Yeah. So anyway, the phases of the game are very, very simple. You have this deck of cards, and like I said, the decks are put together differently. So there's similar card types in the game, but they're going to be distributed quite a bit differently depending on what you have there. Like, for example, the game talks about something called an ambush. And, I'm looking through my cards trying to figure out where's... Because I was playing Great Britain, and I think, Cody, you were playing France.
Yes.
And
Oui.
So, and I was flipping through my cards saying, I can't find any ambush cards. I wonder if I got a mispacked copy. Then I look at the chart that's in the game, and, neither of those armies even come with ambush cards. So it's very catered to the different kinds of armies.
It's not the honorable way to do it.
I guess not. Yeah.
You know, I forget which battle it was in the American Revolution, but I either read a book or watched a documentary where there was one battle where British soldiers had clear shots on George Washington, but it was considered against kind of the rules of battle to you don't shoot at officers.
Yeah.
Wasn't
that like the big thing in the American Revolution, that the first evidence really of guerrilla warfare, where the American troops were hiding behind trees and stuff, and the British were just marching out there.
And we would go after officers, and that was considered very deplorable and dishonorable.
Yeah, I guess it turned out okay.
I guess it did.
Anyway, so in the game, you're going to start off with a five-card hand, and you're going to discard in as many cards as you want at the beginning, and then draw back up to five. Then you're going to get to move, and moving is very simple. You can move one unit, and you can move infantry one square or you can move cavalry one or two squares. And the only big thing that they mentioned about eight times in the rulebook is you cannot move diagonally.
No.
Nothing can happen diagonally. No battles.
I would rather they say it eight times than not say it enough.
Right.
I'm fine with that.
That still didn't stop you from asking about every 5 minutes, can you move diagonally? Ha ha.
It was fun.
You're slowly driving me crazy. Then you're going to have a combat phase where you can initiate one combat against someone who's adjacent to you. Unless you have like an artillery car, an artillery unit that you could use that would be able to bombard and do that from up to two squares away. You know, and then you resolve the combat, and then you have like a restoration phase where you can possibly restore a unit that's been injured. Pretty much all the units in this game get two hit points. When they're injured, you turn them over and they have like a lower strength value. And then after they get another hit, then they're taken off of the board. And there's really only one number on each of these chits. It's just a strength value.
Yeah.
And so everything is governed by how these cards work. So in the game, if you want to do any kind of an attack, an assault or an ambush, something like that, you have to play a unit card that matches the unit that you want to use. And on that unit card, it's going to tell you what you're going to roll to be able to attack. And I forgot to mention that this game comes with quite a few polyhedral dice.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of odd for a war game, really.
Yeah, you know? Usually it's just very tiny D6s.
Right, so it comes with D10s and D8s, and you know, so that's very fun. And they're in the different colors, too, so you can just go by the color if you're not a role player. and so it'll say perhaps, you know, 1D8 is your going to be your attack roll. And so then you can do things like playing leaders, which will help to boost your attack and also to allow you to kind of combine attacks with other units. And so there's all these different cards you can play. And then there's defenders can play some special defense cards that will be able to increase their defense. And then after you've played all the cards that, you know, that you have the opportunity to play cards, then you're going to roll the die, compare your numbers. And then, you know, really depending on how much... It's like it depends on how badly you beat the other person, right?
Right. It's not just a I win, I lose.
Exactly.
There's kind of levels of victory.
You know, so there's like a whole combat chart that comes with that that says that, you know, that if you know, if you're equal to the defense total, then there's no effect, right?
Now, we mentioned charts. Now, we don't want to scare you away. As we'll get into later, you know, this is a good toe-in-the-water sort of war game. The charts are very simple.
Yeah, you get one little two-sided reference card that tells you everything that you need.
All you need to know.
And it's great. It even talks about the terrain and the effects that those things have. But so, you know, if you're – Cody mentioned this because I'm actually using this as a reference right now to help. If you equal the defense total of your opponent, then there's no effect on either side. If you're greater than that – then the defender will choose to either retreat or take a hit. And this is where I think it gets fun. If you're greater than or equal to twice the defense total, then the attacker gets to choose whether the defender retreats or takes a hit. If you're three times greater, then the defending unit has to take a hit and retreat. And if it's four times, then it's eliminated outright. You know, so there's an incentive here for kind of piling on the bonuses to be able to, you know, completely beat out your opponent's defense value. So there's, you know, that's going to be your main like assault that you're going to do for infantry and things like that, and for cavalry. You can also do bombardment with artillery units, which are going to be a higher die to roll, but you know, you don't get as much of an opportunity to add attack or add defense to it. So it just becomes more of a shoot and see if you hit kind of a thing. But that is basically how it works. Then you can, like I said, you can possibly do a restoration phase where you might be able to restore one of your units by playing some special cards, supply and regroup cards, things like that. And then the game would go to the other player. So that's the whole game. And you know, you're just going to play until that one of those two victory conditions. So Cody, well, why don't you tell our listeners about our patented? Did we get the patent?
No, we got Flo, working on
this. Okay, all right. the review system
here on Game On with Cody and John. We're going to go through buy points, try points, and deny points. Buy points are what John and I consider to be great aspects of the game that make you want to go out and buy it right away. Try points are points where it depends on the person. Some people may like it, some people may not. And deny points we think are just abhorrent, deplorable things that should never be talked about again about a game. Does that roughly cover it?
That's about right. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
No problem.
So what buy points did you find for maneuver?
I think the biggest one is that This is the beginning war game I would steer people to, you know, and not just because of my Memoir 44 Command and Colors kind of hatred. I think this, if someone says I am interested in getting into war or potentially getting into war games, you know, that looks interesting. I might be able to do that. Memoir 44 is not going to give you a good taste of it, I don't think, because it's very, you know, there are added complexities of that Command and Color system, but it's not really indicative of what 90% of the war games are about.
Yeah, you're not going to jump from Memoir 44 might be good for, you know, you want to get the feel of the period or whatever, right. You know, but you're not going to jump from that to Combat Commander Europe, I don't think.
Right.
I don't think that's going to be a good bridge.
And I'm not really trying to pile on to Memoir here. I mean, it's a fun game, and people like, especially in Overlord, it's a lot of fun. But I think if you really want to get into war games, this is a better representation. You have counters. You have kind of a modular board. It more simulates what a war game would be as far as like with charts and the counters and all that. It's really nice because if you end up liking it, like John mentioned, there's so much in the box. You know, you have 8 armies, you have different kind of terrain, you have different scenarios. I think you get a really good value for what you get, and I think it's probably the best introductory war game. Probably if you like this, then you're ready to move on to other things. Yeah. And I think there's a nice learning curve. I mean, it's pretty easy to learn, but I think there could be a lot of complexity and strategy here. So I think it's the total package for someone wanting to get into war games.
Yeah, I'll echo that. I think that I really enjoyed the fact that it's got so much replayability to it. It's got really great components to it for being, you know, what they are. I mean, we play a lot of like Fantasy Flight games with all the chrome and the you know, cardboard and everything and the miniatures. But, you know, it has very solid components to it. The cards are of really nice quality. They're small. They're like kind of the tinier cards. Mm-hmm. But I think you just get so much in this game. And I think it is. It's really... when I've sat down to look at war game rule books, it's really kind of a slog for me, especially the way GMT writes their rule books. They have like the 1.1.
And they the old style.
Yeah, like, you know, I think that's the way Advanced Squad Leader is written too. You know, in this game, I think is written with those same, there's like 6.1, 6.2 and that kind of stuff. But it's really written in a very, it's written, the rule book's written in a caring way. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, it's almost like the person who wrote this, and the designer of this game, by the way, is Jeff Horger, who was nice enough to provide us a copy of the game, so we really appreciate that. But, you know, and it's almost like if he wrote this rule book, too, I would say that he was almost having that in mind of, you know, this is the first war game that you've played, you know, because, you know, it even says, and I'll just read this real quick here, it says, before reading the rules, read this. Do not try to memorize the rules. On your first reading, ignore the rule cross-references. After you have scanned the rules and cards, examine the game pieces. Then play through a couple of turns for practice. It's like it's got this little tutorial aspect in the very beginning of it. So I think it does have that whole package for beginning war game.
And a note on that style of rule book, you know, the 1-0, the 1-0.1 sort of thing. That's kind of a relic from the Golden Age, as it were, because a lot of those games... you learned by being taught, you know, that seems dumb. Of course you learn by being, but you don't learn, you know, maybe one guy hashes through the rule book and really gets it. But a lot of the time, you know, people in clubs or, you know, either local groups or wargaming clubs, or whatever, they just kind of learn from each other and use the book as a reference. Because right. I found, you know, I learned Federation Commander, and, you know, when I was then using the rule book as a reference instead of a learning the game document, it's really nice because it just says, see cloaking rules 3.4.1, and you just boop, and you're right
there. It is, huh?
You know, so it's that kind of, it's really nice once you've learned the game. It's not quite as nice for learning the game from scratch. Yeah. I don't know which I prefer, you know, more the traditional kind of board game rulebook style or this very technical sort of thing.
Yeah. So what about try points for the game?
It ain't much to look at. I mean, it's I mean, it's functional, but, you know, it's not winning any art awards or anything. But to make it a try point, not a deny point, the design does not take away from the game.
Yeah.
Things are not hard to read. Things are not hard to understand. It's just kind of bland.
Well, see, I'll disagree with you there, because I really thought that the, I thought the artwork and had like some it had photos. It wouldn't have been photos, I guess, but they had some paintings and things of the actual generals and things like that. So I thought that was done pretty well. But
it's okay.
But okay, so you know, I'll defer to you as the graphic designer and overall artsy fartsy guy.
Thank you.
What about deny points? Any
maneuver spelled wrong on the box? So I mean, yeah.
Okay.
All the friends, sacre bleu!
Mon Dieu. No. But I. Yeah, I don't have any deny points for this guy. I think it's a solid game. And, yeah, if you're looking to get into war games, this, we would really encourage you to check this one
definitely
out.
Definitely try this one out.
As an introductory one there. So that's Maneuver.
Oui, oui. Hey, before we go, we got a lot of great response to our Kickstarter episode. We had it was a pretty polarizing issue. We had a lot of emails,
varied opinions.
They were either very pro Kickstarter, very anti Kickstarter, and we actually have two voicemails that I think display both sides of the Kickstarter argument, both pro and anti, pretty well. And one that even calls me out.
Yeah. All right. So here's the first one that's sort of on the pro side.
Hi, Cody and John. This is Ray calling in from Pennsylvania, and I wanted to call in reference to your Kickstarter show. And one thing that I haven't heard in all the discussion about Kickstarter talked about much was not purely its capacity to produce award-winning games, but its capacity to produce niche market games, games that publishing companies wouldn't produce because there's not enough of a market. Whereas with Kickstarter, your market can find you and fund a project that might otherwise not be able to be made. And I think the potential there for people to get games that they want that otherwise would never see the light of day is pretty good. And so I'd be interested to see what sort of games like that come out, even if they don't reach mass critical acclaim. Thanks a lot, and really enjoy the show.
All right, thanks for that comment. And I think that brings up a real good point about, you know, getting games, you know, to the market that wouldn't ordinarily be, you know, be there. I mean, you know, I mean,
that's kind of that grassroots thing, you know, that's the good side of Kickstarter.
Yeah, yeah. So now on the other hand, we have this voicemail from
this little gem
from you just have a listen.
Hey, Cody and John, this is Ben Lott. Just calling in real quick about the Kickstarter topic that you guys had on your last episode. Just wanted to throw my two cents in, and well, that is to say, it absolutely mystifies me. I do not get it at all. There are people out there who are just throwing gobs and gobs of money at these unknown properties, just taking a chance on these games. I think I understand the mindset behind it. People in any hobby like to be on the ground floor of something new. They want to be the first one in their neighborhood to have the new hotness or whatever. And I get that. What I don't get is when you don't know the publisher, when it's just some unknown dude who's got his game, he's thrown up on Kickstarter, and people are willing to just throw money at it. And you don't know how good the game is going to be. Maybe I'm just not blessed with the same disease that other gamers have, because I'm a game player and not a game collector. I mean, I do have a lot of games, but I never can see myself backing anything on Kickstarter, because there are so many established games that have been recognized as good quality games that I haven't tried yet. So why would I take a chance on some new thing that could be total garbage when I have an opportunity to pick up, you know, some game that's been around for years and years that I've never even tried? I guess just to sum it all up, thing that hit me the most was when you guys were talking and Cody was talking about the one Kickstarter that he's in on still, and the way he phrased it was the maximum amount is only $100. only $100. I mean, it's like, and I realize the mindset he's got that the stuff he's getting is worth more than $100 he's putting into it, but I see this so much with these Kickstarter-aholics, these people who are backing so many things, that, you know, it's only $50, it's only $60. And yet, when a new game comes out, or when the prices go up to like $50 on an established game like Kick to Ride, people raise a stink. And yet they're willing to jump in on these, who knows, could be total garbage games. It amazes me. And to see the same people who complain about shipping costs. Oh, I'm in the board game Geek Secret Santa and I gotta pay $30 to ship a game to Japan. And yet I'll throw $80 into a game I've never even heard of until today because, well, I'll be the first one to have it, or because they're throwing in an expansion when I get it someday, 30 years from now. I know I'm exaggerating, but it's just, the whole thing is beyond me, I gotta say. And anyways, I really love your show. I appreciate you guys talking about it. It was really interesting hearing your perspective. And keep up the great work. Bye.
So Ben is pretty pissed, apparently.
Not a fan of the Kickstarter.
Not a fan.
And just to reference the $100 thing, you should know, Ben, of we're both very staunch believers in make your gaming dollar count.
And, Cody even more so than me, and I'm getting there.
And $100 is not chump change by any means.
Nothing to sneeze at.
Good, you know, when you're dropping to Ben Franklin. You better be dropping on something good. I just mentioned, because the value of what you get in that, you know, with all the Castles and Crusade stuff, I think that is quite worth $100. It's worth probably about $200, really, when you think about
especially
it.
Especially if you're already a fan of Castles and Crusades.
Exactly.
Now, this is, you know... And I know Ben just kind of called us out on that one thing, but really, in that specific case, that is a specific product that has been out for a while that a lot of people are aware of. So, I mean, if you know that product, I think it's actually a really good deal for that. But I can see his point that if that was $100 for all these books and things and stuff that were from some unknown entity.
Yeah, I would not be so quick to jump on it.
Right,
and I later found out it's the kind of Kickstarter project you hate, where it's just a pre-order system.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah, I'm not as big a fan of it. But
how do they police that though? I'm just not sure if they're going to have.
Hey,
any
Kickstarter
way to
will take their money.
That's probably true.
Hey, they'll take their 3% and go home happy.
Now vote wisely with your dollars, listeners.
No, the other, we received a lot of emails and comments on another subject. Now,
yes.
John and I played a game of Innovation.
Innovation. Great game.
It's fine.
It's a good game.
I thrashed you in it.
You did. Seemingly.
Well, however, there was, after the fact, there was maybe some discussion that we played it incorrectly.
Let's just say that law enforcement has gotten involved.
It got serious.
Yeah. So have a listen.
Hello. This is Constable Franklin Detritus of the Rule Enforcement Division. It's a completely ceremonial, voluntary organization. At any rate, I'm calling to investigate an incident reported in your podcast, number 75, I believe, in which Mr. Cody Jones states that he won a game of Innovation with only age 1 cards in his tableau. What we are trying to determine is if you were following the rules stated in the game structure section of the rule book, subsection Achieve, which states that you need to have a top card of equal or higher value than the number of the achievement you wish to claim. Now, this is a common mistake. I made it myself in my early days. That being said, if this is indeed the case, I'm going to have to rule Mr. Jones's victory null and void and insist you play the game again. Please contact me at your earliest convenience. Thank you, and have fun gaming.
Okay.
Hey, I didn't want this to escalate. So, yeah, we did play it wrong.
Thank you, officer.
Thank you to the thousands that emailed.
We had many emails, yes. And very, very, you guys are all very smart. Very smart gamers.
However, as in the NFL, there was no challenge issued at the time.
Oh,
so I have to disagree with the officer.
Wait a minute.
It still counts as a
win.
It still counts as a win.
Fine.
And, you know, you'll...
With an asterisk.
No, not with an asterisk. It's a win.
That's terrible.
It's a win, and we'll play again, maybe using the real rules. But
how do you sleep at night?
You had nothing to say at the time. You had nothing to say at the time. It was fine. I'm trying.
I didn't know that I had poor counsel. I had no counsel. I didn't know the rule. I had forgotten the rule.
The band was on the field. I still scored the touchdown. It was a win.
Oh my gosh.
So thank you everyone for your emails and voicemails.
This is what I have to deal with now. I mean, it's not just the podcast listeners. This guy is supposedly my best friend and the person I play games with all the time. This is the crap I have to deal with.
A win is a win.
Oh my gosh.
What you play to win the game, you don't play to just play it.
That's right. As a matter of fact, let's hear from Coach Herm Edwards. He has some wise words for us.
This is what's great about sports. This is what the greatest thing about sports is. You play to win the game. Hello? You play to win the game. You don't play to just play it. That's the great thing about sports. You play to win. And I don't care if you don't have any wins. You go play to win.
I guess Coach Edwards didn't specifically say that you have to play to win the game fairly.
That's right.
Okay. Are we done? Are we ready to close the show
up?
Let's
finish this thing off.
All right.
All right, we not only play to win the game, we play to finish the game on episode that you're listening to.
Yeah.
See what I did there?
Wow.
I should just stick to my normal shtick. Thanks for listening.
This episode's running kind of long, isn't it?
Thanks for listening to another warlike episode of Game On with Cody and John. We'd like to thank our great sponsor, Myriad Games, who sponsors us on behalf of friendly pro professional game stores everywhere.
Everywhere.
And, game stores are going to be a big feature of our next episode as it's time for our annual gift guide episode.
Tis the season.
It is Krisma, Hana, Kwanzaa.
Exactly. Whatever you might be celebrating this time of year.
Festivus.
Colts victories? Probably not.
No.
But we'll have a whole list of different kinds of games.
The best gift guide out there.
That's right. With our own special Game On categories that you're only going to find here at Game On with Cody and John. So tune in for that and we'll have all of your gift guiding that you need, all the guidance that you need.
Imagine it, sit the next few plays out there, Curtis Brainerd.
Alright, so anyway, that's about all we've got for you for this episode. Hey, we love making this podcast for you. Until next time,
Game On.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at GameOnPodcast.com. Join our guild on BoardGameGeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at GameOnPodcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on PulpGamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On.
That's the great thing about sports. You play to win. And I don't care if you don't have any wins. You play to win the game. You don't play to just play it. You go play to win. When you start telling me, it doesn't matter, then retire. Get out.